Live from Los Angeles, it's the Life Changes Show.
Look at the bright lights. Look at the bright lights.
With tonight's guest, co-founder of Edge, the Echo Defense Group, Nathan Edmondson.
Look at the night sky. Look at the night sky.
And musical guest, Mark Baranov. I am Mark Leger, and now your host, the MC, the Master of Change, Filippo Voltaggio.
I am so looking forward to tonight's conversation. It's been a conversation that I've been wanting to have for decades. Actually, as long as I can remember, because as a kid, I used to think that there was so much injustice in the world and someone should do something about that and someone should do something about that. And I remember trying to encourage the people around me, do something about that, because I was just a kid, didn't think that I could do something about it. Well, I grew up and went to college and got a job and I started making money. And then I thought, now I could do something about it. So I remember giving money to this organization and that organization and da-da-da-da-da. And I remember wearing the shirt of this one and proudly telling people about that one. And only to come to find out that one of the organizations that I was giving money to, none of the money went to help the animals. And another organization actually might have been maybe hurting the animals that they supposedly were supposed to be helping. And then, and this and that. And I thought, and I just, I felt like I was now part of the problem. My ignorance was part of the problem. And I gave up on everything until I figured I would take the time to research better before I give money to anything. And then I didn't. Life got busy and now no organization was getting my money. And I never found the ones for the longest time that I felt were, this one's the real deal and this one's really helping and all that. So at the Life Changes Show, we've really tried to be very, very careful with where we say, this looks like the real deal. This is over here supporting, because there are issues in the world. There are so many that we bring to the fold in our conversations here on the Life Changes Show. And this one in particular, if we're talking about animals getting extinct, actually, we learned from our guests, just in passing, because there's such a big conversation, that just 3 months ago, one of the animals that we're going to be talking about, one of that part of the species 3 months ago is now extinct. And this is happening as we speak, actually. So that's why this conversation is so important. We feel like, thanks to our friend Doriana Richmond of Stone Symbol, who's with us today, who says, Filippo, I've done the research, da, 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 you know, and Mark and Dorothy. This is great as our family grows and as we get to know people that are out there in the world doing things and that we could support and that you all could support as well, especially at this time. What a great opportunity we have. And so really excited about speaking with Nathan Edmondson of Edge, Ecological Defense Group, and a little later on, live music here in the studio with Mark Baranov, who will be joined by Marina Manoukian, all on the Life Changes Show when we come back after this.
You are listening to the Life Changes Show, recorded live from Studio NoHo. You can hear tonight's show and all our past shows, which include luminaries such as Marianne Williamson, Gary Anthony Williams, Sierra Campbell, and Alan Roderick Jones, on our archive page at lifechangesshow.com. You can visit us online via Twitter at Life Changes Show and Facebook at The Life Changes Show.
We're back. I'm Filippo Voltaggio, sitting here with Mark Leger. And Mark, we've titled this show, Answering the Call to Stewardship of Endangered Wildlife. But it could be about so many things.
So many things. But the authenticity, the integrity that you spoke of, I think, is really at the heart of tonight's show and why I'm so excited for it. And I shared that same exasperation as a child and as an adult when I started to look at, you know, who I was going to partner up with even before we did the show. And then, of course, all our years and really trying to figure out who's real, who's not, who's actually getting it done. And so to hear about this and be able to support is a great conversation. conversation tonight.
Well, and it feels like the beginning of a long relationship here.
For sure.
And interestingly enough, our guest started as a, well, who knows how he started, but he's a comic book and screenplay writer. A lot of people know him for that. And the co-founder of EDGE, Eco Defense Group, a nonprofit organization formed for the production of endangered wildlife. Welcome to the show, Nathan.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. We've had several phone conversations and finally got to meet in person. And each time, I mean, I know you're busy with all these careers and juggling all of this stuff. I mean, can we say, let's see, you're working on Prodigal TV, but I mean, people know you from with the Marvel Comics stuff. And I don't want to, Black Widow, The Punisher. I know you don't like this part, which I love that about you. You're like, no, let's talk about the animals.
Yeah, indeed. My books are not in crisis, but the animals are.
Yeah.
No, I mean, look, it's interesting the word used earlier, stewardship. It's not a word we use often. And I was thinking we should use that word more because I think that, you know, talking about whatever career path leads you to do something like this, the idea of stewardship is that, you know, you give something back. And I think you reach a point where you start to think about, you know, a lot of careerism is what you're taking from the world and kind of how you're processing the world. But conservation is a very difficult subject in a lot of ways because it's been hugely controversial and highly ineffective in a lot of ways. But if you think about it in terms of stewardship, then you think that we have a role in this world that we're born into. And so it's kind of accepting that role. So we can talk about books all night long. I'm happy to. But I think that whatever I've learned in the writing and whatever platform I've gotten, you know, serves now a role that, you know, I think is something we're all born into.
You know, in an interesting sort of way, I was looking through, you know, just getting to know you as a guest and as a person, and I was looking through the very successful things you've done in your role as a comic strip or comic book writer and a screenplay writer and all that. And actually, I was, I didn't find it. Maybe it's there, and we don't have to dwell on this, but I was kind of hoping that one of the characters someday will be an animal, and the hero. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And as you were sharing just before the show started, how the white rhino, which now is extinct, you said as of about 3 months ago, is now almost mythical. Generations from now, somebody will say there was a white rhino with a horn and da da da, and it'll almost be like the what's the unicorn, right? And so technically there could be this quote-unquote mythical, not mythical, character that you could create.
No, the Tasmanian tiger is a great example, right?
Yes.
I grew up hearing about it, seeing, you know, the grainy footage, and it does. It's mystical because it no longer exists. Like dinosaurs, there's a reason we're so fascinated with animals that have become extinct because our imagination has to fill that void, but it's unnecessary. Now, I was talking with a screenwriter who's working on one of my movies, on the way out here, actually, and I'd written a movie for one of my favorite actors about him and a wolf, and we're talking about our inspirations growing up, and I thought, Black Stallion, White Fang, and we were realizing so many of the movies that inspired us, he and I, talking about Jack London and other things, were about a relationship between a person and an animal. I think there's certainly, I don't know, there's something that makes us more heroic when we have a connection like that to something that you have to connect with at a level that you can't convince or cajole or, you know, sell yourself to. So I think there is something fascinating in that idea.
Actually, speaking of inspiration, you have a person who is inspired who also is connected to animals in a big way, or at least brought big animals in a big way to our awareness. Let's talk about him for just a moment.
Assume you're talking about dinosaurs and Michael Crichton.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and I do have a Michael Crichton tattoo on one arm.
Seriously? Okay.
Yeah. So what's unique about this approach, because I can kind of trace a lot of things in my life back to Crichton. I started, I think when I was in first grade, discovered one of his books, Jurassic Park. It had just come out. I didn't know what it was. I knew Jurassic meant dinosaurs.
As a book.
Yeah. And so by the end of second grade, I'd read all of his books to date, reread them every year, wrote him a letter every year to meet. But so much of my formation of thinking, I think, came from him. And he had very unique and very contrarian, as he was in all ways, views on conservation. In some of his later books, he wrote, for example, about the failed stewardship of Yellowstone and how much we learned in the disastrous attempt to conserve Yellowstone.
Oh,
and
wow.
Part of, you know, the way that he looks at it is we have to be dynamic in our learning of our interaction with the environment, but we also have to recognize that we play a part of that environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're part of nature. Mm-hmm. We like to think of nature as something totally detached from us, but you can't think that way.
Interesting.
We do protect ourselves from nature, and that's why we're, you know, in a building with walls and a ceiling and, you know, air conditioning. We protect ourselves and insulate ourselves from nature, but in reality, you know, we everything that we do is a part of a natural order. Whether it is destructive or not is a different question, but understanding that relationship. And then he had a lot of interesting things to say about extinction. So as we're talking about these animals disappearing, he made it very clear these animals aren't coming back, you know. Mm. But even if they do, there's the gap in understanding the environment because we weren't stewards of it is a very important disparity to reconcile. And so anyway, there's a lot of his writing. He spent a lot of time in Africa, obviously did a lot of research and even brought it into the Lost World and Jurassic Park to understand how game parks and things work. And the way he looked at our misunderstanding of those environments, I think, was very informative in my thinking.
Well, speaking of your thinking, what were you thinking when you saw a group of people doing things in Africa to help prevent the extinction of animals, to help prevent poachers killing them, et cetera, just for a tusk or something? So what were you thinking? Were you thinking, oh, that's a nice thing to get involved in?
Well, what I think excited me was, and I think it initially I thought there was a story in it. I think my perception of kind of conservation was about as much as 99% of people. Of course, I don't want animals to go extinct. Of course, we must preserve. But I didn't have a great
deal.
But
I'm busy over here.
Yeah. I realized so much of what I thought I knew was just wrong. You know, we're sold sort of a commercial version of how conservation and preservation works. But and a lot of it is, you know, kind of manufactured to sell you on supporting this organization or that. But what excited me about it, my point is that a lot of it becomes noise to us.
Mm.
You know, you stop sort of thinking about it as a reality and you think of it more as a commercial, you know, a fundraising issue. At least that was very much, I think, the case with me without even realizing it. But when I heard that there were people from the special operations community from unique places who I was working with in other areas, I was working with people with really unique military connections and backgrounds and army science and things. And when I heard that some of them were over there starting to do some counter-poaching work and doing really surgical and sort of mission solution type work, I was fascinated because I thought these are resources that have never been used over there.
Mm.
And I got to see what this is about.
Mm.
So I found one of the people there, met him, ended up traveling with him. But again, I certainly wasn't going over there to save any rhinos myself.
Mm.
I was going there just because I was fascinated what was happening.
Wait, so when you say resources, you're talking about highly specialized people that have been trained in certain fields that don't normally get involved in that, right?
Absolutely.
So like what?
Well, some of it, honestly, we can't talk about.
Yeah.
But
right.
I mean, obviously, everything we do is cleared in a way, but they have unique training protocols and things that they are trained in. But their backgrounds basically are at a level for warfare solutions, like the ability for six guys to go in and defeat an army. That's their world. And then, of course, there's technological resources that were being used from battlefield network communications to genetic researchers that were being found and brought over. And that's what I saw was happening, that there a lot of organizations, Edge was founded out of need, not out of mission. So a lot of people wake up, and there's nothing wrong with that, they wake up and say, I'm going to go save a rhino today. We're going to build a nonprofit. We're going to go over. We're going to do this work. Edge was different. Nobody in this group woke up saying, we're going to do this. There were some people behind, but what happened was they had conversations saying no other organization can solve these problems. Here are some problems that need solved. They're practical. We need a pragmatic approach. We need unique resources. So there were some individuals who were sourcing those resources in really radical ways and cutting through a lot of red tape, you know, doing. And when we got together, I just I'm an energy person. So I got over and I said, oh, well, how do we keep this going? How do we do this and this? And realized, no, these people are over to do a job and leave. So we sat down and said, how about if we don't leave? How do we keep finding these unique resources? And so EDGE is, in other words, it's not an institution, but a dynamic.
It also sounds like a disruptive organization, one that's very needed. And you talk about it as if it's a war, and it sounds like it is. So when we come back, let's talk more about why you describe it like that. And then we'll talk about solutions as we're talking with our guest, Nathan Edmondson of EDGE, Ecological Defense Group. Now, if you want to already go and learn more about it, you can go to ecodefensegroup.org. That's ECO, defensegroup.org. So we'll be talking more about all of that with our guest. And then a little later on, live music with Mark Butanoff here on the Life Changes Show when we come back after this.
Hey, guys, this is Michaela. So I'm here to tell you about the DNA Institute. If you haven't heard of it already, I wanted to let you in on it because it completely changed my life. A few years ago, I was 30 pounds overweight. I wanted a career, good friends, a loving family, and financial success, and I didn't have any of it, so I ate. Within 6 months, the DNA Institute treatment not only helped me lose the 30 pounds, it also rebalanced my hormones, healed my metabolic and digestive system, and made my higher functioning brain so loud it became impossible to overeat when I was full. Don't we all want that? So many of my friends and family turned to the Institute after they saw my success. All of them lost their desired weight, ranging from 8 to 60 pounds. I found this to be so different than anything I'd ever tried before, and it was easier than anything I'd ever done. It's not a supplement or a diet pill. It's a genuine, doctor-prescribed, custom medical treatment made just for you. It doesn't matter what your situation is or how much weight you have to lose, I believe the Institute will get you to your goal. My experience is that this is more than just a weight loss system. It's a biohack to a better way of looking, feeling, and living. When I started, I had never heard of the DNA Institute, but the fact that they've been in Beverly Hills since 1982 gave me a real peace of mind. Now that you've heard of them, click on the DNA ad at lifechangesshow.com and get your customized formula started today. Change your life like I changed mine.
You are listening to The Life Changes Show, live from Studio NoHo on the BBS Radio Network. You can hear tonight's show and all our past shows, which include luminaries such as The Green Children, Dan Millman, Hot Rod Fuller, and Mike Marino on our archive page at lifechangesnetwork.com. You can also follow us online via Twitter at Life Changes Show and Facebook at The Life Changes Show.
We're back. I'm Filippo, sitting here with Mark and, of course, our guest, Nathan Edmondson of EDGE, Eco Defense Group, or Ecological Defense Group. It's a nonprofit organization that is... it's a disruptor, as we've been talking about, if you've been listening to us, and it was formed for the protection of endangered wildlife. So Nathan, we've been talking about this. You have special ops people on this. So special ops, that's war conversation. So why are you looking at it as a war?
Well, I think you have to step back and look a little bit at the history of certainly lower Africa, sub-Saharan. I mean, poaching has always been an issue, especially since, you know, there was colonization of Africa. But it's, you know, there's been an imbalance in the relationship with wildlife for a long time. That imbalance manifests also in human-animal conflict or human-elephant conflict, where you've cut up territory for farmland and, you know. But if you look back, so poaching was an issue. Groups like Boko Haram further north get funding from ivory trade. And of course, once you build a pipeline, whether it's for ivory or anything, everything goes through human trafficking, weapons, drugs.
So some people don't know before we go on. So poaching is going into where one shouldn't be and taking what one shouldn't take. Is that usually in the case of animals?
Yeah. The Afrikaans word for poaching, which is an excellent documentary everybody should see, is strip. And it means literally to strip. You strip the part of the animal off. So you're exploiting an animal for a piece of it that is valuable.
And some people don't know that piece, a lot of it is ivory, and it's in the tusks of the tusk of the elephant and the horns of the rhinos, right?
Yeah. So in South Africa, Zimbabwe, Botswana, early 2000s, rhino poaching was not a huge, huge issue. Now, the use of rhino horn has been used in Southeast Asian medicine and Indian medicine for a long time, but they started to see something happening on the ground in the parks, which was, I think, starting 2006. I'm sorry if I got that year wrong, but there were 12 rhinos killed in South Africa, which was kind of it's like the shot heard around the world. They started to realize something was happening. What they didn't realize was that in half a decade, they'd be looking at 1,200 animals killed in 1 year. Yeah, and basically nobody was prepared for the tide of radical violence that was going to come in. So, of course, what happens is you have to arm and protect. So the rangers, who are the true heroes, if you want to make a story out of this, mm-hmm. there is no hero greater than a ranger who's willing to stand between the poacher and the rhino. But what was happening was...
Which could mean their life.
Absolutely. For whether it's from, getting killed by a buffalo or a snake or shot by a poacher, mm-hmm. this is a highly dangerous occupation. Mm-hmm. But what they do on behalf of all of humanity, right? Because when they don't stand between the rhino and the poacher or the elephant and the poacher, that animal goes extinct, you know? So what started to happen was in Southeast Asia there, especially because of a rise in cancer due to pollution and other issues. That's one of the factors, one of the most significant ones that drove the value of rhino horn, which is now the most valuable material on the planet. By some measures, more valuable ounce for ounce than diamonds, gold, heroin, even human trafficking, if you measure it ounce for ounce.
Wow.
Because of its belief to be a cure-all for cancer, for virility issues. So when you've got a resource that valuable, right, it's like anything else that's worth fighting a war over. I say worth in quotes, right?
Wow.
So the poachers come in, the rangers defend, and then escalation happens. So what you've got now is not just poachers. I mean, you can see little escalations. Began with... for example, poachers coming in and shooting the rhino to kill it and then killing the horn. But the shot then is detectable. So there's a response to the shot. Poachers can get caught, so they put suppressors. Suppressors mean they can't aim well because they're rudimentary and large. And so they're wounding the animals more often. So then they have to bring a hatchet. But then they realize they could get away with just the hatchet. So one of the things they do now is stalk the animal, sever its spine with a hatchet blow, then cut its face open to remove the horn while it's still alive. And they'll do it to the calves as well.
Now, while they're still alive.
While they're still alive. Now, these poachers who are often, you know, very, very poor local, you know, community people, come in and get 3 years pay for a weekend's work or something. And it's very dangerous for them as well. But what you're seeing now, you've seen in parks, AK-47s are becoming more common, RPGs, pipe bombs, all meant for the rangers and their dogs. So in response...
To kill the rangers and the dogs.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Right. They'll set traps. Wow. They respond now. Engagement. And of course, it depends on where you are. There's different rules of engagement in different countries. But overall... The demand is rising, the conflict is escalating, and it is truly a war. It's not a war that can really be won because it's an ongoing campaign, and as long as, you know, it's almost like a catch-22. If you just let the animal die, you know, but of course they'll move on to the next thing. So in other words, the better the job they do, you know, the more at risk they are. That is, every animal there. So if you talk to farmers, for example, who have game farms in countries in Africa, they... don't want to take on a rhino. Rhinos you can get fairly cheap, actually. They don't have a lot of value compared to something like, you know, a buffalo or something that is actual, you know, make use on a farm. A rhino is a liability. If you bring it on, your family is now a target. You have to pay extraordinary money for security. So, and the rhino, of course, is not the only animal. There's tiger paws being, or, I'm sorry, lion paws being cut off and swapped for tiger paws. Pangolins are being poached for their scales. Birds, all kinds of things. But
see, now I don't even know what a pangolin?
It's kind of like a big anteater with huge scales on its back. It's very rare and very, very cool looking.
Wow.
They look like, you should just look one up. They're pretty cool.
okay.
But anyway, the point is the rhino is now an umbrella species. So if you protect the rhino, you protect the biosphere. But of course, this is a war, and to anybody who fights it every day, they fight it without the rangers we work with and that we support. They've told us, you know, we don't get a day off. We don't get to go home for 3 months. We don't get time off this war. So you work with the rangers. You try to make warfare asymmetric. You try to anticipate the evolution of the evolution of warfare. And this is what our guys are good at. You anticipate it and you get ahead of the curve. You make warfare asymmetric. And that's what has to happen. It can't be responsive. It must be anticipatory. And you have to evolve faster than the poachers do. Now, that said, part of our ethos with Edge is that you don't just work in protection, you also have to work in communities. Because if you're not training the next generation to come and do it better, then you're not thinking ahead. And also, you can't do any work in conservation without community buy-in.
This is actually the same community that is probably poor, and they're, this is how some of the people within their community earn money.
Yeah, I was with a ranger not long ago who told me he was... they were on a track, which means they're following the spoor or the trail of poachers. And they came up, and one of the rangers raised the gun, walked forward, and then he walked backwards and lowered the gun. It was his cousin.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. So talk about community. That you can't get more close than
no,
that.
No, I mean, and so it's a binary choice very often, like, you know, to become a ranger or a poacher. Like, some of the rangers live for fear of their lives because they have family members who are poachers, and the family prefers that because they bring in more money.
Yeah.
Right? So if you can, the value to many of these communities who really have a birthright, certainly a geographical right to these animals, you know, beyond us, Edge tries to be as non-imperialistic as possible. We recognize we weren't born there, we won't die there, and therefore there is a first right to the conservation of these animals. But it, but of course, it's a global interest. It's something not just global, but eternal. You know, past, present, and future will all be judged by the animals we let go extinct.
Yeah.
So, but when we're there, many of those animals have no value outside of being poached, and part of that is due to education. So one of the things Edge tries to do is bring famous painters, photographers, and other artists, and then... look at developing trades and other life skills in communities and crisis conservation zones.
Wow.
So that, one, we bring, if you can teach a kid to paint a rhino, we brought 45 kids from a village, probably about 5 kilometers, just over 2 miles, right, to an area where they could see rhinos and elephants. 45 kids, I asked them to raise their hands. How many have seen a rhino before? 3.
Wow.
3 had seen one, and they lived that close. So to them, that's an abstract concept, if anything. Mm. All they know is it's – but if you can teach them to look at it and paint it, meet a ranger, all of a sudden it takes a different form in their mind.
Yeah.
It becomes an object of art. It becomes something that has value, and then they realize that art skill has value. So you've brought somebody to the community that didn't exist before, and you have to sustain it, of course. But Edge, anytime we're working – with the rangers, our ethos is that we're also doing an effort to help the communities, and that they make that connection, and that they also make an economic connection, that these animals have value, and that value exceeds the value of stripping their face off for a horn.
You know, we first came to know of you, of course, because we received an invitation several months ago where at the Stone Symbol House, Doriana Richman was having an event where you were going to be there, but rangers were going to be there, right? And they were, and we missed an opportunity to meet them. None of us could go, but these are real people, and these are people that are putting their lives, their families on the line, and what I'm loving about this conversation is that it sounds so sustainable, where eco is a great word, where you're working with the ecological system of the community, of the land, and of the world, of the animals, and all of that.
And that is the difference, I think, between management, for example, and management and
stewardship
like, and conservation. Conservation would say, just protect. Just go put a fence around it. But recognizing that part of that ecological system, as you put it, part of that is the community that lives there.
Yeah.
So you're right, these rangers who we brought over, by the way, we brought these rangers over the first time in history that African rangers have done professional development on U.S. soil. And we brought them over, they trained, they did extraordinary things. It was something that was requested, and we made history in our first year. It was pretty awesome. But what was also awesome is talking with the head ranger, this group, the special rangers, who are a quick reaction force that we've worked with, who are surgical and awesome. These guys are young, and most of them are young, and they're if they go to work, their family's at risk, and they're at risk. But one of the things that shocked me because we drove them on a tour of the country a bit. We had some extra days. We decided rather than
our
just,
country here,
yeah, from okay. Colorado, they went through Moab, they went through Las Vegas, they came to LA, and I was sort of thinking, well, that's nice for them, but we really need to get down to work when we were planning the days. And I talked to the head of that group, and I asked him, "Hey, do you think they had a good time?" And he said, and this was also at Doriana's house when mm-hmm. they were so incredibly honored at everybody who showed up and, you know, basically paid their respects to these Rangers and donated money. And what he said was, it is so valuable to them to see the way, to see how important their work is to the world. Mm. And I didn't even think about that to think. He says, no, they go to work every day. They don't think. And in fact, no matter how great the Ranger, they're all at risk of being recruited and corrupted because the money, they get paid so little, the danger is so great, and the money is so huge. One of them, for example, his son has diabetes badly and can't afford the medicine. We've, you know, helped him with that. But, I mean, literally, if it's saving your child and someone came along and said, hey, just bring these guns inside, and I don't want to say no one would blame him, but I'm saying that this is a very difficult situation. Yeah. And he said, the way they've seen through the lens of everybody's eyes here, they had no idea how important their work was to the world. Wow. And that was an unintended sort of benefit, but I guarantee you they will be the leaders of counterpoaching and conservation of the next generation, these guys.
That's the most powerful thing that I'm learning about what you do is not only, you know, you're changing worldview. It's so easy to talk about the fight, which gets more fight, but you're changing the worldview. You're educating, you're reframing the whole situation around art and education and awareness. It's absolutely amazing.
And I would like to emphasize too that we don't try to go in and impose any of these thoughts, but we go into the community and say, how can we help? You know, what can we do that's interesting here? So we try to, in all things we do, be partners. None of us are risking our lives. I mean, some of the environments are a little bit dangerous. I've been turned down for life insurance a few times now just because I go there. But we're not the ones putting on our plate carriers. We're not the ones who are at risk of mamba, buffalo, leopard attack. And we're not the ones who do it every day. And when you're on a poacher track, you know they're lying in a bush somewhere ready to shoot you. So that is, and they do it for an animal. You know, a lot of guys go to war for their country, for whatever. What they do is for animals.
Wow.
It's incredible.
Wow. This is all incredible. I'm so glad we waited to find the one to have the conversation with. And again, thank you to our friend Doriana Richmond. We'll be right back with more with Nathan Edmondson, kind of like beyond the war, like what we could do. Obviously, we can give and raise awareness and we can share on social media. There's more we can do. So we could start at their website, ecodefensegroup.org. Again, ecodefensegroup.org. And boy, what a great time of the year to be having this conversation too. But actually, it's all year round. It's 24/7. This is what we're getting here. When we come back, we're not only going to have Mark Badenoff in the studio as our musical guest as well, joining us in a little bit, but Marina Manoukian and Dorothy's going to be in here as well for our Ask Dorothy segment, all on the Life Changes show when we come back after this.
The Little Dog That Could is the fantastically true story of a man and a little dog that came into his life as his mentor to help him understand the world beyond his human senses and to experience life, love, and healing beyond his human understanding. Best-selling author Filippo Voltaggio, who currently hosts the highly regarded Life Changes show, is an internationally known singer, speaker, and life coach. Filippo offers up his own story, how one little surprise package in fur and four legs transformed his life unexpectedly forever and furthered his path of self-discovery. In The Little Dog That Could, Filippo brings to life the meaning of the adage, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. Through the reading of this book, you will experience the journey of real miracles that transcend time, space, and logic while gaining practical tools that will help you navigate your way. The Little Dog That Could is available through Amazon and Barnes & Noble. For more information, visit thelittledogthatcould.com. That's thelittledogthatcould.com.
You are listening to The Life Changes Show, recorded live from Studio NoHo. You can hear tonight's show and all our past shows, which include luminaries such as Mariel Hemingway, Shadow Stevens, Barbara Morrison, and Kyle Cease at our archive on our website at lifechangesshow.com. You can also follow us online via Twitter, at Life Changes Show and Facebook at The Life Changes Show.
We're back. I'm Filippo, sitting here with Mark, and joining us is our guest, Nathan Edmondson, here on this show to talk about answering the call to stewardship of endangered wildlife. Well, speaking about answering the call to stewardship, we have had the pleasure of knowing Doriana Richmond for quite some time, actually. Mark introduced her to the show. We had her on the show, and she is such a dynamic person. She's into real things, and one of the real things she's into is jewelry, actually, that we're all wearing today, interestingly enough. That we'll have to take a picture of that, actually. Yeah. She's got this stone symbol that she, you could go to the show that we did with her and learn so much more about it. But she has not only taken on this cause and brought this group into her community and shared about EDGE with so many people, not just us. She had that event we spoke about, but she's giving a percentage of all the sales from the stone symbol to EDGE. So for people that buy the stone symbol in jewelry, well, if you follow her, you'll see her beautiful people wearing around their necks, on their fingers, on their arms, mm-hmm. On their heads. I don't know. They're wearing them everywhere, on their rings, on their fingers. You could go to stonesymbol.com, and learn more about the jewelry, buy the jewelry there, and know that your money is going towards EDGE. And Nathan, what else can people do in support of EDGE?
Yeah, and by the way, Doriana has breathed so much life into us, and her stuff is extraordinary. And the unity of purpose between protecting wildlife and sort of bringing beauty, you know, through jewelry has been just an
fine
awesome
jewelry,
inspiration.
No less.
Yeah. Oh no. Silver, everywhere I wear this, I get compliments. Yeah. Look, we're a baby organization in a lot of ways, and we intend to stay very small and nimble. One of the unique things about us versus a massive group is a lot of transparency. You can see where every dollar goes. The boots we put on rangers, the bulletproof vests, like everything that we need, the genetic elephant research. It's a very clear path from your dollar to the ground, and we invite you to come see where it goes. On our website, you can give directly. We've also on Twitter at Eco Defense Group and Instagram also at Eco Defense Group. But on Twitter especially, we're pushing a GoFundMe right now that we'd like to put a lot of heat into. This is a giving season. And this is, there's a lot of causes out there. This one has spoken to us loud and clear, and it's not just speaking, but we see there's a lot of problems in the world, and there's not always a clear solution about what you can do for them. To us, we all know we're in the right place at the right time to do something about this. Every single donation is hugely effective. I mean, Filippo just tonight said he was going to give $100 to our GoFundMe.
How much did I say? Let me write that down. How much did I say? Is that how he is, Doriana? Yeah. Good for you.
Yeah. And Dorothy. I mean, she was so generous.
What about Mark? Yeah.
Mark said his was too large. He didn't want to disclose it.
Yeah, I can't get
it. Didn't want to embarrass you.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Very exciting.
Yeah, so please join us. And honestly, join us. We're a community. This should be a community effort with a lot of transparency and communication. So we invite you to not just, hey, go throw money at us, but keep up and keep us in conversation.
You know what is interesting is that, everything we've spoken about, but like Mark said, you know, the community, the military on the one hand, and then the scientific on the other side, the arts, the photography, community, and all of that. And then you even mentioned about the kid who had some kind of disease or something and helping him as well. I mean, that's so big. You need a lot of, you're just getting started. You need a lot of support.
Yeah, we had,
you're doing so much
when we got together, we made a list of all the projects that we were sort of connected to see what we could carry on. And we said, okay, how do we pare this down? You know, what are the most pressing? So there's no end to the effective work we can do, and we have excellent, excellent devoted partners. You can see on our site, there's, like I said, a lot of transparency. We're very, very strategic. We're very surgical. We don't throw money at anything, and we overlay everything. So like I said, if we're working 1 kilometer this way with the Rangers, we're working 1 kilometer the other way with the community, because one doesn't work without the other.
Nice. Nice. Thank you so much. More power to you. And I look forward to your films about animals and the other ones too.
Yeah.
I'm just saying the story is so rich. So I'm looking forward to the expansion of it on many levels.
It's a beautiful, rich part of the world worth exploring and appreciating, everybody.
Nathan Edmondson, thank you so much. Edge, Ecological Defense Group. .org. Eco, actually, defensegroup.org. Energized by that, we move on to our Ask Dorothy segment.
Hi, Dorothy. This is Cara from Oxnard. I love the Life Changes show and want to thank you for introducing me to it when I had a private session with you. My question is this. Why does my best friend always tell me that what I am thinking is not what he believes I'm really thinking? I came to the conclusion a long time ago that our minds don't come close to working in the same way, and I made peace with this factor because I recognize that he loves and respects me very much. However, sometimes I feel that he expects me to process information the same as he does. He's very intuitive and is an amazing life coach. I appreciate it when he helps me figure out what is truly going on in those times where I'm confused. And then there are those times when he insists that I am not being truthful with myself or with him when he questions me and asks what's going on. The truth is that there is a whole lot going on inside of my head most of the time, and that I often need space to process it all, and so I will say that I'm okay because that is my truth. He will push and push and push until I blurt out a partial answer, and then he will say, aha, I knew you were upset and you said you were fine. This doesn't feel good when this happens and will lead to a long discussion in which I do my best to explain that there is a lot going on. Then he will accuse me of defending myself, which I believe means to him that I am lying to him and to myself. I don't like this behavior. How can I handle it better in the future?
Cara, thank you for a very interesting question. And there is an easy solution. The next time this occurs, you can make the choice to honor yourself by not blurting out your first thought and instead say this. Thank you for asking, and I really am okay. It is just that I simply need some time and some space to process what is going on because there is a lot I'm thinking about, and I want to figure it all out. And then, if needed, I can have a truthful and honest conversation about it with you. Thank you for honoring me enough to support me and gaining the clarity I need in this moment by allowing me the time I need to discover what is actually going on. If he really is your best friend, then he will understand. Cara, it appeals to me that there could be a deeper issue here for you to examine. When we remember that we are the co-creators of everything in our lives, we can better understand why certain things occur. We invite people into our lives to assist us in becoming the very best that we can be. So you may have a contract with him that includes his behaving in this way as a service to you so you can fully awaken and become happier and healthier by consistently choosing response over reaction. I intuit that this is exactly what is going on between the two of you, as it feels as if you have come into one another's lives to assist you both in evolving and becoming better and better and better.
Thank you, Dorothy. And if you have a question for Dorothy, please write her at askdorothy@lifechangesshow.com.
And we'll be back with our musical guest, Mark Bodenoff, right after this on the Life Changes Show.
There are self-help seminars costing thousands of dollars guaranteeing miraculous transformations. There are compelling speakers and life-changing weekend experiences where you can walk on fire. They all deliver revelations that guarantee you'll come back for the more expensive revelations filled with even greater wonder next month on Fiji. We get addicted to positive, heartfelt, expensive theater. What we really need is a jumpstart, an awakening. Someone who can give us a reminder that everything we need lies within.
Through inspiration and practical knowledge, Dorothy Donahue helps people get grounded and motivated, inspired and energized. It's not just words and affirmations and the power of intention. It's a mindset brought about by a tangible, transcendental experience, an audio-visual, physical, spiritual experience that helps us realize we transform ourselves. We get tools to become the conscious co-creators of lives of unlimited potential. Find out more. Go to DorothyDonahue.com.
The Life Changes Show is a premier radio show presented by the Life Changes Network, which is a company whose team has dedicated their lives not only to positive change, but to helping others observe and embrace, honor, and even celebrate their own changes, thus enabling a more positive, inspired life and helping to create a more positive and inspired world. From everyday people, celebrities, corporate giants, and children, we are here to help and to serve. With heart, integrity, and experience, we bring our message and positive intent into your lives through the Life Changes Show, lifechangesnetwork.com, and through guest appearances on other inspiring shows and events. If you wish to learn more about Life Changes Life Coaching, a private consultation with one of us, corporate or live event appearances, or if you would like us to appear on your radio or TV shows, please email us at info@lifechangesnetwork.com.
We are back. I'm Filippo, sitting here with Mark, and of course, our guest, Nathan Edmondson. And if you haven't figured out by now, Doriana Richmond is with us here in the studio. Joining us now is a man who came all the way from the Soviet Union and soon after became the associate concertmaster for the L.A. Phil, otherwise known as the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra. He was that for 37 years. He's still with the organization as first chair, as well as first chair of the Hollywood Bowl, and we could go on and on. He solos with many orchestras and has throughout the world, and also is a visiting professor of violin at Biola University and UCLA. Welcome to the show, Mark Baranov.
Thank you, thank you. It's a pleasure for me and honor to be here and answer whatever you want to ask me
about. I want to ask you about coming to the United States. Interestingly, when we've talked about this before, I asked you how was the music different? And you said the music wasn't different, but everything else was.
That's true. That's true.
And with everything else, you meant what?
I meant the style of life, yeah. Apartment, cars, food, relations between people, between leaders, and so forth. But the music was the same, except for many years, it didn't allow us to play contemporary composers, even Russian ones, like Edison, Denisov, Schnittke, many more. Though sometimes they let do it, but only in small concert halls, 200 people, 150 people. It looked good because they sort of allowed to play those pieces, but just for 150 people, that's all.
You know, Mark, I've had the pleasure of listening to you perform many times, actually at the Hollywood Bowl and in the Alignment Music Series events. I found it struck my heart when you said that you were, the opportunity to perform was being taken away from you when you were in the Soviet Union at one point.
Yeah, it's a very last point. Before, it wasn't too bad because they need good musicians, especially string players. And many of those people were Jews. And, you know, many came to America, to Canada, to Germany, to many countries. Mm-hmm. And every orchestra has Russian players, especially string players. No winds, practically. But strings were great. And till some point, it was good. And I even played in Radio String Quartet, and I played in Nonet, nine-musician group, one violin, viola, cello, bass, and wind quintet, We traveled abroad, Prague Spring, Halle Festival, Split Festival. But when generation changed, newcomers, new youngsters came, 21, 22 years old, and they were exceptionally talented, and they hired them because they needed good musicians to go abroad. We played in Germany, in Europe, in all many countries, in Japan, and they hired them. And after 1 year, when orchestra traveled abroad, they saw real life. And six of them decided to leave the country for better life. And the Minister of Culture had different ideas about immigration. They consider it as a treason because they are leaving the country which gave them education, life, and blah, blah, blah. Mm. And after all, they decided to fire all Jews from the orchestra. Wow. And our music director, famous conductor Gennady Rozhdestvensky, he didn't want to do anything with that. He gave the note, he resigned, and they hired some conductor who was conductor in folk orchestra.
In a folk orchestra?
Folk orchestra.
For a classical orchestra?
Yes.
Interesting.
He conducted balalaika, bayan, you know, Russian folk instruments. And he knew that by that time, I am sure, you know, rumors, he knew only Beethoven Fifth Symphony and Tchaikovsky the Fourth Symphony.
Yeah.
And the orchestra played by that time in Bruckner and Mahler, many things.
So he obviously wasn't...
He wasn't ready.
Right.
But, you know, it's very hard to refuse. It's a good job. Good salary, good position. Yeah. And he took it. And little by little, he found out all those pieces. He learned a little bit here and there and started to travel again. And he even was a music director in Vienna Symphony, not Vienna Philharmonic, in Vienna Symphony. Mm. And still he is alive and well. And because of them, because of him,
yeah.
Every holiday we toss his name. Because of him, we left the country, and I brought my son, who became a lawyer. My wife was a professor of piano, and life was completely different, much, much better.
Wow.
And we have piano trio. And you see, it's our fate. Because of bad things, you get much better things.
Well, I'm glad you believe that, and here you are, and here you are, and actually, thanks to Marina Manoukian, who's standing right next to you of the Enlightenment Music Series. I think of any musician, she has been here more than anybody, constantly bringing in some of the most amazing musicians. So thank you for being here and for introducing us to Mark Baranoff.
Thank you, Filippo, and thank you, Mark, and Dorothy, for inviting. It's always an honor and pleasure being here.
It's great to have you. Could you tell us real quickly about the Enlightenment Music Series? Because we have an event. And I say we because I'm the master of ceremonies.
Absolutely. You're our wonderful master of ceremonies. And we're delighted you're going to be once again leading our concert, hosting our concert as an MC on December 15th in Burbank at First Presbyterian Church, 7:30 performance we have. Our music series is dedicated to bringing the audiences great works by lesser-known composers, and this particular concert will be all Baroque. And we'll be presenting works by Albinoni and Lully and Rebel, Locatelli, Corelli. So some of them, the names are not well-known beyond the string player circle, but they're certainly worthy compositions, this concert will be a compilation of works by such composers.
So to learn more about the Enlightenment Music Series, go to emusicseries.org. That's E as in Edward, musicseries.org. And actually, so what are we going to be hearing today?
Well, this evening, since we're talking about Baroque music, Mark and I will perform a duo He will be leading as first violin in a duo by a French composer, Baroque composer, Jean-Marie Leclerc. He was born in 1697 in Lyon, France, and he is considered as the forefather and a founder of a French violin school. He's also a great composer, but a great deal of his works have been lost. So we're lucky to have some of these compositions still surviving. And this is a duo, opus three, number five, for two violins by Jean-Marie Leclerc. And I have to say that it is an inspiration for me to play with a fabulous violinist and a great colleague, Mark Baranov. And this morning we actually played a job together at Fox.
A movie
20th
job.
Century Fox right. Studios, yes, for a TV show. And this TV evening we're playing a duo.
This is awesome. I'm so glad the two of you were able to be here together to perform this. Here we have, we're actually going to hear all three movements, right?
Yes. Yes,
wonderful.
We'll try to squeeze in all three movements.
So we're going to get to hear.
I just wanted to correct you. I was in Russia. I had the third chair of first violin section, and here I had the fourth chair of first violin section. When I came here, I was 38 years old. Mm-hmm. It was a little bit too late to start career here, but I got it.
But you did it.
Yeah, I just wanted to get last stand of the second violin section to get education to my son. But turned out it became.
Turned out you did very well because of your playing, I trust, and we'll get to hear it right
now.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you. Here's Mark Baranov and Marina Manukian performing Leclerc's duo for two violins, Opus 3, Sonata Number 5. Mark Baranov and Marina Manukian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
What a pleasure to have you both here. For those of you who can and are local, be sure to check out the Enlightenment Music Series event on the 15th of December coming up. And I will see you both there, Mark and Marina. And Marina, after that, the next time you and I see each other, we'll be in Sarajevo. Absolutely. In Bosnia-Herzegovina, where I'll be master of ceremonies for the Sarajevo Philharmonic Orchestra's New Year's Gala. And you'll be one of the invited guests in the orchestra or in the Philharmonic. So that'll
be
very special.
I'll be actually leading as a concert master.
Oh, excuse me. You'll be leading as the concert master. Right, of course. And our, wow. I didn't know that. Oh, I knew you were important, but and then conducted by our friend and colleague, Maestro Dino Zonic. How special is that going to be? So learn more about the Enlightenment Music Series at emusicseries.com. Mark Baranov, Marina Manukian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And again, a pleasure. Nathan Edmondson of Edge Eco defensegroup.org or Ecological Defense Group, but ecodefensegroup.org. And then again, let's not forget Doriana Richmond's A Stone Symbol. All sale. How much of the sales? 50%? That's unheard of. 50%? Oh, 50%. So go to stonesymbol.com. Actually, today's Cyber Monday. Perfect. Go to Stones. And tomorrow's Giving Tuesday. So, well, we've got it all. Go to stonesymbol.com to actually, they could see the jewelry on us in a little bit. If they just look at our pictures, stonesymbol.com. Thank you so much to all of you. What a very special show. And happy holiday season to all of us. On behalf of all of us, I think we want to thank Brent Hahn here at Studio NoHo for making us all sound so great.
Thank you, Brent.
Thank you, Brent.
And on behalf of our executive producer, Dorothy Donahue, our producer, Mark Legere, I am your host, Filippo Voltaggio, reminding you that as your life changes like ours surely did tonight, we're here for you. Ciao, everyone.
You have been listening to the Life Changes Show. Listen live every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time and visit us online at lifechangesnetwork.com, on Facebook at The Life Changes Show, and on Twitter at Life Changes Show. Join us again next week as we consciously explore and embrace the only constant, life changes. The Life Changes Network is an entertainment network. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and participants and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Life Changes.